I think I'm going to go ahead and start because I'm real protective of this hour and a half that we have, and I want to have time at the end of this for you to ask questions. And still waiting for one of my panelists to get here. Is Alan Smith here yet? Well, I will introduce him and assume that he's going to be here, and let's just go ahead and get started. As I mentioned in the abstract, I have tried to compose a panel that is made up of single men and women, divorced men and women. We have our last panelist. Thank you. And I tried to get a real variety of experiences. And I think the one thing we have in common is that we are people who are engaged in good causes rather than being preoccupied with causing a good engagement. I will be the first panelist. And my experience is that I was married for 19 years. I've been divorced about two. I have four children, ranging in age from 8 to almost 18. I started a business a few years ago, and I graduated from the University of Utah in Russian history many years ago. And I am also on the Board of Trustees of Sunstone and have been actively involved for the last 2 years in this organization. The first panelist to speak after me will be Kent Frogley. Kent is the vice chairman of Sunstone Board of Trustees, and that is how I became friends with Kent. The reason why I've asked Kent to be on the panel, and we made a mistake in here when we said Kent was single and way over 30. That is true, but we were debating whether we wanted to put sliding towards 40 or way over 30, and we didn't really realize the implication was, you look at that and you think, he could be 60. Well, obviously, he's not anywhere near that. The nice thing about Kent is that he has a large circle of friends. Many of them came here to hear what he had to say about this, but he just has a great network and is really someone that is fun to be with. He got a master's in communication at Northwestern and is currently working for O.C. Tanner. He lived in New York for a while and is back in Salt Lake. Next, Jennifer Sanders. She was a psychology major at BYU. A few years ago was Miss Salt Lake and runner-up in the Miss Utah pageant. Her specialties are violin and voice, and she is in the Monument Park Singles Ward, so she will bring that perspective. She is under 30, though, but well, she has had a lot of dating experience, and that's what everyone told me in that ward. They said, oh, you've got to get Jennifer. She has had a lot of dating experience. The next panelist will be Alan Smith, and he is an attorney practicing in Salt Lake, is divorced and father of three children. The interesting thing about Alan in talking to him was that he had a very good and cordial relationship with his ex-wife. He likes being single and being in the divorced, but he does a lot of things still with his family and with his ex-wife, and so he will bring an interesting perspective to this panel. And the last speaker will be Kathleen Nielsen. And Kathleen is a widow and a mother of three. And I first met Kathleen right after the death of her husband, which was about, what, six years ago. We did a week-long retreat, group therapy retreat together, and since then she has become a very good friend of mine. We do a lot of hiking together, and when I first became divorced, Kathleen was my only single friend, And so I was real needy, and we have stayed good friends because we have similar social needs. After the death of her husband, wrote a book about this experience entitled No One Prepared Me for This, that was published by Hospice and distributed nationally, and she speaks often on this subject of dealing with the death of a spouse or a loved one. But the interesting thing about Kathleen, and part of the reason why I'm glad she's on this panel, is that she has had a lot of, I wouldn't say necessarily dating experiences, a lot of relationships and a lot of experience with different relationships, and so she brings that perspective to the panel. Well, I think that being single in the Mormon Church is a challenge, even though I've only had to do it for 2 years. But the one thing people who know me know is that I like challenges. I like my ski slopes vertical, and I don't even like to go unless I get scared and get a real buzz, and so I'm kind of crazy that way. I like a good aggressive tennis opponent. I don't like to play someone that's worse than I am, that I can beat all the time. I'm just crazy enough to take up mountain bike racing at the age of 42. And despite all this, despite the challenge, I believe that single life has equal potential with married life to produce happiness, satisfaction, achievement, and spiritual progress. But I think we singles need to convince ourselves first that we are not some incomplete person whose life is on hold, that we're just camping, that we're not establishing real roots or really creating a life for ourselves. Many singles make the mistake of deciding what they'll do for a living, where they want to work, where they want to travel, what they do for recreation, driven by the search for a mate alone. First of all, I want to dispel some of the depressing myths about singlehood. Did you hear the one about the 40-year-old college-educated single woman who has only a 1.3% chance of getting married? Well, we all know now that this is wrong. In the book Backlash by Susan Faludi, the Census Bureau found that the college-educated woman over 30 has a 58 to 66% chance at marriage, which was three times the Harvard-Yale study. At 35, the odds were 32 to 41%, which is seven times higher than the Harvard-Yale study. And at age 40, the odds were 17 to 23%, almost 20% higher. And a college-educated woman at 30 was more likely to marry than her counterpart with only a high school diploma. Well, what about the myth of single career women suffering major episodes of burnout and depression? In the studies that Faludi cites, married women report 20% more depression than single women, and three times the rate of severe neurosis. A 25-year longitudinal study of college-educated women reported that married women had the lowest self-esteem, felt the least attractive, and were the loneliest. So I guess I come to this panel with the perspective that I am optimistic. I'm not depressed about my chances of finding someone that I would be interested in. Now, the church has a statistic that was put out in 81, and I just asked Marie Cornwall and Tim Heaton if that had changed at all, and I'm sure you've heard it, that a single active Mormon woman, that out of every 100, there were only 19 single active Mormon men, and that is a statistic. I remember just after my divorce, I was talking to my sister, and I was telling her, I said, the problem is there's no one out there. And she said, Robin, that's not true. She says, you only need one. That's it. You just need one. It doesn't matter what the statistics say. You just need one. Okay. Well, whether or not we are happy with our single life, most of us are looking for a zestier social life. We are all searching for meaningful relationships and friendships. And I have the opinion that the best place to start is to develop single friends of your own sex first. And in a panel I was in yesterday, they called this kinship libido. I like that term. Developing friends of your own sex first. And this is probably more pertinent for people who are divorced or widowed maybe than singles, because you probably have that established already. But as a married person, I spent 19 years developing a wonderful network of married friends. We did things with our married couple friends, and I have study groups and friends all over the Salt Lake Valley and the country. But my married friends have different social needs than I do, and I discovered that right after my divorce. I needed more than just being invited to the neighborhood barbecue. I wanted to meet other single individuals. One friend introduced me to a newly divorced woman who lived in Orem. She had also been married to a physician like I had, and we ended up taking several ski trips to Aspen, and from that point, I met other women who were divorced who had similar needs as I did. I think after you have established that kinship libido and you have friends of your same sex, then I think the next step is to become friends with other single members of the opposite sex. Someone that you can call on when you want to go on a bike ride or you want to go to a movie. And I think this is a stage that you shouldn't skip. A lot of times people say, well, okay, I'm divorced now. I'm ready to start dating. Line me up. And I think that you need to have this network established also of male or members of the opposite sex that you are friends with, that you can enjoy some of the same activities together. What I've found is that I can have more intimate friendships with single males than I can with my married male friends. Well, it does a little bit, but right now I don't feel like I could call up my next door neighbor Brian and say, let's go skiing, or my neighbor Blaine, or even though I have a very good relationship with them, you have to deal with the spouse and their jealousy. And the farthest thing from my mind is to become involved with a married man. It is not a possibility. I've been too hurt by that experience, and that would not be why I would call him up to go skiing. But the perception is there, and so I found that I can establish a better, more intimate friendship with single men than I can with my married friends. I think that the mistake a lot of people make is they think, I am getting out. I'm going to movies. I'm going out to dinner. Why am I not meeting people? Well, let me tell you a clue. You can go to movies for the next 10 years and never meet anyone there that's new. That is not the way to meet new people. That's been my experience. I think what you have to do is you have to become involved in the kinds of activities that you love. And if you are doing those kinds of things, and if you're out having a good time and enjoying your activities, that way you will meet new people. And so I made a list of some things that that would interest me more than, and may you. Some people say, well, when they first got divorced, they joined something like the Wasatch Mountain Club or a bike club or something where they could go on hikes with other people that, and just a chance sometimes to talk while you're hiking, and that worked for them, or they would sign up for something like a two-day bike trip, where when you're put in situations like that, you talk and you connect, whereas sometimes you don't do that just by maybe taking a class somewhere or sign up for a singles river trip. Join or form a singles book club. Sometimes you have to take the initiative, and you have to reach out, and you have to be the instigator and the initiator. You can volunteer for a political candidate. Attend a singles war. That works for some people. It doesn't always work for divorced people, because my needs, I have children who need the programs of the church. Join some kind of group therapy that may fill your needs. For example, that's how I met Kathleen, or maybe you want to be in a codependent group or something like that, where you're sharing problems. another thing, go to a...
Isn't that like meeting
someone? Yeah, that's exactly. What about going to a basketball game? Those who know me know that I am a real basketball freak. And I not only have Jazz season tickets, but like I also sign up. Like when the NCAA comes and they play four games in one afternoon, I go and I sit through all four basketball games. But it's interesting. I meet people because of my interests. What I do a lot is I ski alone. And I go up to Alta, which is, 90% men? And single, you get in the single ski line, and you meet people as you're going up and down the ski slopes, and you meet people from all over the country. And I don't, I just want someone to ski with that day. I don't want to bring home, somebody. But I always have a good time, and it is an experience to have an interesting conversation. If you are involved in activities you love, you will enjoy the event, even if you don't meet anyone new. Now, I've been attending this symposium for 6 years, and for the first 3 years, I was married and struggling with my marriage, but I would come to these, and I knew maybe two or three people, and I would come enriched, and I would buy books and tapes, and it would keep me just excited about the church for the next year, and I was thrilled. But about 3 years ago, I met my friend Marty Bradley after one of the sessions, and she says, "Go, Rob, I see you here every year. We should really get you involved in Sunstone." And she asked me at that point to help be on the board of trustees, and that changed a lot my experience with Sunstone. I come now, and this is my family. I feel like I know half of the people that are attending. I know your names. I've seen your registrations. I feel like this is my community. And so for me, you'll notice my list doesn't include single war dances and dance clubs, and because I don't expect to find someone there that meets my need or that has the same interests as I do. So I go places and do things where I am hoping to meet new people. And I look at the experience of meeting new people, and I really enjoy it. I don't always think, well, is this a dating? Is this a person I want to date? You've got to start thinking of terms. This is an interesting friend. Well, and I think that the last resort is a lineup. I really generally hate getting to know someone this way, but I have had a couple of good experiences and met some neat men through friends, but I've also had an equal amount of disastrous evenings. I hate the feeling of going to the door and not even knowing what this person looks like, and spending half the evening with very mundane conversations you're trying to find out about each other. That isn't an experience that I enjoy. It makes me very uncomfortable. Finally, what do you do when you start to date someone you like? How do you create and maintain a relationship while developing intimacy? Just falling in love doesn't guarantee a compatible relationship. And trying to rush intimacy is like trying to make bread without letting the dough rise first. There are stages a relationship has to go through, and often people will try to leap from that staged intimacy without the intervening steps. And I think during those steps, they come to understand and honor the other person's thoughts and feelings. Men and women define the term intimacy differently. But for me, in a truly intimate relationship, you feel safe enough to let your partner know where he could hurt you, knowing that he won't. That, to me, is my definition of intimacy. Well, next comes the big question. Are sex and intimacy the same thing? Can you truly be intimate without sex? And I think this is one of the big questions that are facing the over 30 single Mormons. I personally don't feel that sex either destroys or creates intimacy. I think the two are very separate. I think that in a lot of ways, sexual relationships complicate a relationship. And let me explain a little bit what I mean. I saw a movie recently, and it's at the Tower Theater. It's called Lovers, and it's kind of an erotic movie. I hate to admit this with my parents here, but the one thing about this movie, it was interesting. It was a love triangle, and you had a man and a woman in Spain who were engaged, had been engaged for a couple years, and the man gets involved with his landlady, who is a very seductive, erotic woman. And when the young girl, his fiance, finds out about it, she makes the decision to offer her body to her fiance in hopes that she can compete against this other woman. And what happens is she does this, but in a way she can't compete on that level with this woman. She is a novice. This other woman has had immense social and sexual experiences, and she cannot compete with this woman. But what happens is she has given her body to this man, and the end of the show is very, very tragic, because she feels like she has given him everything, her love, her body. She even gives him, she saved 40,000 pesos, and he deceives her and tries to take this money to help his lover, and she ends up wanting to commit suicide because she has nothing left. And what I see happening is that there is a lot of similarity sometimes between Mormon women. I asked two or three men what they thought the difference was between Mormon women and non-Mormon women that they had relationships with. Were they easier or not? And it was interesting, because the experience was that they weren't any easier or any harder to get into bed. The difference was is they carried a lot more baggage with them in terms of, to them, sexuality was a spiritual significance, and to them they couldn't separate the two, and they would say, well, now are you going to marry me, and I've got to fulfill my... my marriage has been such a goal for me, and I've got to fulfill all of my expectations, and it was just too much baggage. And so sometimes it's almost better to not have to deal at all with that. And I think you can have a relationship and make a decision about who you want to marry without having to deal with all of that sexual baggage as well. I remember calling my friend Kathleen one night after I thought I had all of this figured out. I'd been dating for about a year, and I thought it was real easy. And I called Kathleen one night after a first date with a guy, and I said, Kathleen, what am I going to do? This is really hard. It's not easy anymore. How do you do this? How do you maintain not go to bed with him on the first night kind of thing? And she read me this this poem from Shakespeare that we like to share with each other. She said, and this is from Shakespeare again, "What win I if I gain the thing I seek? A dream, a breath, a froth of fleeting joy. Who buys a minute's mirth to wail a week or sell eternity for a toy? For one sweet grape, who would the vine destroy? And what fond beggar but to touch the crown would with the scepter straight be stricken down?" And I think the point of this is just to get beyond the moment and make a conscious decision about what you're choosing, rather than to let your emotions and your passions make those decisions for you. In a recent network magazine, I remember reading about a woman who was remarrying after she'd been married, or several years of being single, and she struggled with the decision. She looked up the word husband in her dictionary. To manage, it read. Animals, she thought, are husbanded. Vineyards have husbands, and women have husbands. But do I need a manager? I think I'm doing absolutely fine by myself. And this is the dilemma that I face, is I feel like I really like right now being single. I think I'm doing a good job managing my life and handling and raising my four children. But I don't know if I want to spend the rest of my life alone. And I think that's where a lot of singles are coming from in this church, is that it's hard to give up that that autonomy, but we need to be out there and have a lot of good relationships so that we have the knowledge to make the right choice and pick the right relationship that's going to be good for us. Thank you.
I think it's interesting how many people have their parents here today. I guess when you're single, they can never quite give up on you. They want to make sure you're doing it right. Robin mentioned different ways of meeting people. I hope that nobody missed the LDS only Latter-day Ideals poster, which is prominently displayed on the bulletin board. My favorite statement here is, "Latter-day Ideals is a private business which operates in complete," which is an interesting word, "harmony with and fully supports the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints," which to me is a guarantee of good quality inventory. So we'll leave that.
It's a dating service.
Are you interested? All right, that's right. Well, but I saw his name in there. I wanted my remarks this morning to express more than my own experience as a single person. As the program says, and this is Robin's little joke, way over 30. Actually, I've started telling people my age in base 12, and so I am 30. So I talk to a lot of single people, men and women, barely over 30 and way over 30, never married, divorced, widowed, gay, and straight. And there was one trait that seemed to be fairly common, and that is that single people over 30 don't date much, if at all. The reasons are varied. In many cases, they're just never asked out, or they never ask anybody out. In other cases, they've been hurt once too often and are now unwilling to risk emotionally. Or they are tired of the games that accompany dating, so they only date when they meet somebody they have a genuine interest in. The casual, more frequent dating of the early 20s seems to have been replaced by a more discriminating dating. Many single men over the age of 30 are not interested in single women over the age of 30. They're interested in the 22-year-old Miss Hotbody that they met at the Bay. single women over the age of 30 aren't interested in the nerdy male in their nerdy male peers. Many professional women find themselves dating down on the socioeconomic scale. Men employed in blue-collar trades or those still deciding what to do with their lives are intimidated by professional educated women who make more money than they do. And I think this is something that is accentuated in Mormondom by our emphasis on traditional roles of women as caretakers and men as breadwinners. There was a couple that I knew after their first child, the husband, who was still going to school at the time, decided to stay home and take care of the baby since his wife had a career that she enjoyed and was making a very good living. He found that he liked staying at home with the baby, and so he dropped out of school totally to become the primary caregiver. And his wife was pleased to continue her role. That arrangement worked very well for them. However, the husband caught so much flack at church, particularly in priesthood meeting, from people making remarks like, when are you going to get a job and support your family, that he quit attending. That's the environment that we operate in. When women do date, they seem to date only non-committal men. Oftentimes, these men are devoted, believing church members who are dealing with a homosexual orientation. They continue to date as a front to support their heterosexual facade or in a desperate attempt to find a woman who is going to cure them. My friend Linda, a single woman in her late 30s, plans to title her autobiography, The Men That I Have Loved Who Have Gone On to Love Each Other. Gay men and women face the double stress of staying in a church that not only illegitimizes their single status, but illegitimizes who they fundamentally are. Still, some people cope. A friend of mine in another state told me of a man in her ward who is openly gay, is active, who dates men. He holds himself to the church dating standards. I says, well, what does that mean? She says, well, it means that he kisses and holds hands, but he doesn't have sex. So, these are complex issues that constitute a very broad spectrum of experiences and circumstances, and I can't address each one of them here. I will only say one thing in respect to each, and that is learn to be happy with who you are. Do not look to a spouse as somebody that is going to complete you or fill up the empty parts of your life. If you want to be happy married, you need to know how to be happy single. As the song by Laurie Anderson says, the gift of life, it's a twist of fate, it's the roll of the dice, it's the big wheel, the big ride. Jump in and enjoy the ride. There is one other thing that single Mormons deal with, and that is how the church treats singles. Several years ago, I attended a luncheon at the University of Utah, and I was seated at the table with several people that I didn't know and hadn't been introduced to. The luncheon hadn't begun, people were finding their seats, and a man walking by recognized the man that was sitting across from me, exclaiming, well, Richard, how are you doing? You still bishop? He said, yeah, I am. He goes, in the singles ward. With great sympathy in his voice, he said, oh, you're kidding. That's tough, but I can top that. I'm a bishop in a singles ward that's 60% women, with most of them over the age of 30. And they both groaned and laughed and said, oh, how awful. In that moment, I saw the most common mindset found in the church about older singles. The church actively discriminates against older singles. They are rarely called to leadership positions. Women more often are called than men. Single males being considered for faculty positions at BYU require special approval from the Board of Trustees before they can be hired. Single men over the age of 27 are not allowed to teach seminary or teach in the church educational system. If they are married and become divorced, they are fired. In essence, these people are viewed as people with problems. These are people that are incomplete, people that need to be fixed by fixing them up. The two bishops laughing at that luncheon, by operating from that mindset, perpetuate the problem that they think they are fixing. People are very often willing to behave in the way we expect them to. And what amazes me even more is how many single people are willing to buy into that self-view. We view ourselves as incomplete, as broken. We view ourselves as incomplete and broken people. And as Mormons school to be ever obedient, we buy into the perception that we are second-class citizens, fundamentally disfigured, without the requisite partner to waltz into celestial glory. So we wander into singles wards created to address our, quote, special needs that, in my experience, singles wards I'm referring to here, either exude the tragic air of a leper colony or, in the more robust wards, come across as a disco with hymns. Because of our theology, we can't escape the emphasis on family. Like continually poking at a bruise, singles hear over and over again in church about marriage, children, and the eternal family, constantly reminded of what they do not have. It's a fact of our theology that will not change. I don't see how it could, but I do understand why so many people withdraw. I think statistically the highest incidence of inactivity within the church is amongst single men over the age of 30. And they withdraw because affirmation is so rare. And when singles are affirmed by church leaders, it is often in a patronizing manner as an adult speaking to a child. We are not adult children. There is a viewpoint that permeates the church about singles. Single women are viewed as victims who will be avenged in the life to come and rewarded with a man, perhaps a man who is already married to several other women, but a man nevertheless that will complete them. Somebody with a perfected spiritual penis to procreate with into the eternities. In the meantime, my mother is turning red. In the meantime, single men who fail to marry in this mortal life will move through the eternities as spiritual neuters, without offspring. As singles in mortality, we were viewed as broken. Now, without the perfected genitalia of our married counterparts, we truly have been fixed in the final eternal sense. Single men are viewed as the victimizers, receiving no reassurance about the afterlife, but instead are solemnly warned, we will regret this dereliction of duty into the eternities. These single women rattling around the wards of the church are our fault. What is ignored, or very often invalidated, is that for some people, being single may be the choice that God would make for those people, if he were allowed to infringe upon their free agency. God knows that people very often make the right choices for themselves. I think it's time for a new mindset in the church that treats people as people, that understands that single people are no more screwed up than married people, and that being single, for whatever reason, is a legitimate, acceptable place to be. Marriage shouldn't be one more condition that we place on ourselves to feel loved of the Lord and spiritually whole and worthy before God. I'd like to relate an experience that I had this past April. I was in Minneapolis on business, and I spent the weekend there visiting a friend. He's a 37-year-old returned missionary who's left Mormonism. He invited me to attend church with him on Sunday, and I agreed, although in the past I never really enjoyed other church services. It may be my cultural bias, but I've never felt any spiritual response at other denominations' church services, so my expectations were not high. But as I watched people coming into the service, and as I listened to the wonderful sermon given by the woman who was ministering at the church, and as I watched people take communion and hug one another, I began to ponder my own spiritual journey, and I had what became, in a sense, an epiphany for me. I have always heard that God loves us unconditionally. I have told that to many people, and I really believe that God loves other people unconditionally. However, I've never believed that God loves me unconditionally. As often as I had been told that, I never believed it, and I'd never really stopped to think about why I felt that way. Until now. I looked around at these people and felt the incredible spirit of acceptance that they had for each other, and it hit me why I never felt God's unconditional love. Even though in the Mormon church we are told God's love is unconditional, my experience of Mormonism, God's kingdom on earth, is that everything is conditional, and we learn most deeply what we experience, not what we are told. Everything in Mormonism is conditional. Baptism is conditional. Drink iced tea and you can't be baptized. Temple attendance is conditional. Callings are conditional. Speaking in church is conditional. Everything is conditional. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I know that conditions provide benchmarks for measuring our strivings towards righteousness. But we translate these conditions that serve as goals into conditions of God's love towards us, and even into conditions of our love towards other people. We are a checklist church making the black marks on the test sheet that will be read by the celestial optical scanner. We see the score and pass to the corresponding level of heavenly glory. Marriage is another condition placed on full acceptance and fellowship into the church, and I think that's wrong. Marriage is a condition required for exaltation in the celestial kingdom. And I don't think I'm overstating things if I say the church is not the celestial kingdom. So what do I think should be done in regards to the things I've just rambled about? First, singles, take responsibility for your own life. If you feel sorry for yourself, knock it off and get on with your life. Quit acting like a victim and make some specific plans, then take some specific steps to change the things in your life that you don't like. You're really the only one who's going to make a difference. Secondly, the church needs to treat single people the same way they treat married people, as adults. Get rid of singles wards. Tell singles to go to church and focus on worshiping God rather than finding a date. Dealing with the kaleidoscope of people found in a typical ward is where much of the richness and spiritualness of life is experienced. Too much time in the homogenous ecological niche of a singles ward, and you end up with a bunch of inbreds. If singles have special needs, and some do, deal with them in a normal ward system as the special needs of married or children or widows or teenagers or the elderly are dealt with. Don't concentrate them all into a singles ward where the sheer numbers of singles and their problems create a lethal toxicity that scares off the healthy. When I attend church, I don't want special attention. All I ask is not to be illegitimized by the choices I have made for myself. I don't think that's too much to ask. Thanks.
Well, I've had a really interesting week. I just returned from being down in Cedar City with a group of all women in my family and enjoyed seeing four of some of the best Shakespeare plays, I think, that have ever been written. And as Robin called me on Monday evening and asked me to speak to you today, I was a little bit overwhelmed. I'm 26 years old, so roughly that turns into having about 10 years of being in the dating arena. And when I thought of my dating experiences, I realized what a complicated, interesting experience it has been. I have a calling in the singles ward that I'm currently in, and I think that's the only reason I am still at the singles ward attending. It really is amazing, and I have to agree that singles wards can become an opportunity if taken to get lost in problems and focus on things that are not healthy. And I always said that if the men in the singles ward that I attend were to go back east or to go out of the state of Utah where there aren't so many gorgeous, beautiful women, they'd come back and be married in a month. You would be amazed if you were to see the women and the men in the singles ward that I attend. Absolutely brilliant, bright, attractive, successful people who seem to look around at each other and be in a constant state of confusion, and they're lost, and it really is amazing. And so I would be an advocate, certainly, of people returning to their own individual wards where they can have an opportunity to serve and give and work with young people and work with elderly people, which is, I believe, a far greater stretching and growing experience, which would prepare us as singles under 30, over 30, whatever age, for dealing with what may come in a marriage situation. I think we all know that there's happily married, happily single, unhappily married, and unhappily single. And for me, while marriage is definitely a goal and something that I am striving to have in my life in the future, I'm very happy to stand here and say that I'm happily single. And I think that that's a far greater blessing and much greater advantage to be happily single rather than unhappily married. basically, it's been a great experience for me to sit here and listen to the other two members of the panel speak, being young and not having maybe a different experience to draw from. I've learned a great deal. I hope that I can influence you as single people, as parents, those of you who might have children. Being a psychology graduate and pursuing a master's degree, I'm going to pull a great deal of my remarks from focusing on a psychology basis, the psychology of being comfortable with yourself. I had a very healthy perception of womanhood and being single. I have a very traditional family. I have two parents who have a wonderful marriage. I am the oldest. I have an older brother. I'm the oldest girl. And I have two younger sisters and a younger brother. My two younger sisters are married and have children. And the first thing I had to learn to deal with was started at their wedding receptions when people came up to me and said, "But aren't you older? What's wrong with you? How come you're not married?" And I think if we can all learn to take the aspect out of each of our lives, that we would be a lot healthier. I was a very late bloomer. I was extremely unattractive in junior high. Definitely went through that awkward stage in high school. And so I had a choice. I made the choice, instead of disappearing inside myself, that I would develop my personality and hope that someday someone would see that rather than what was on the outside. So I had about 4 or 5 years to learn how to like myself, to learn what was important. And after that, I had kind of an amazing transformation take place. I really almost became a different person physically. And I thought that this would be really great. But what I learned was that along with this newfound physically attractive outer shell, I became very, very insecure because I lost what I feel should guide a search for a mate, or what should make you feel good about yourself, or what makes you feel attractive. I participated in a lot of pageants and used that as a tool to develop my talents more, to become comfortable, because back to the uncomfortable stage, even though I had a lot of opportunities to work on my inner self, I wasn't comfortable with people looking at me. Even though I had changed outwardly, my self-confidence and my self-esteem hadn't changed along with that. And so I chose to participate in something that would allow me to be out and give and develop my talents and be comfortable with people so that I could learn how to better accept myself. I feel that a lot of us don't really want to be found. This is based on my experiences as well as experiences of friends that I have who have dated. And one of my favorite books, and I hope I don't get in trouble for naming, but it's a book by Robert Fulghum. And I'd like to read a story that he's written. And I think all of you will relate to this, and it'll maybe bring home the point that I'd like to bring home. In the early dry dark of an October Saturday evening, the neighborhood children are playing hide and seek. How long since I played hide and seek? 30 years, maybe more. I remember how I could become part of the game in a moment if invited. Adults don't play hide and seek. Not for fun anyway. Too bad. Did you have a kid in your neighborhood who always hid so good nobody could find him? We did. After a while, we would give up on him and go off, leaving him to rot wherever he was. Sooner or later, he would show up, all mad because we didn't keep looking for him. And we would get mad back because he wasn't playing the game the way it was supposed to be played. There's hiding and there's finding, we'd say. And he'd say it was hide and seek, not hide and give up. And we'd all yell about who made the rules and who cared about who anyway, and how we wouldn't play with him anymore because he didn't get it straight, and who needed him anyhow. Hide and seek and yell. No matter what, though, the next time he would hide too good again. He's probably still hidden somewhere for all I know. As I write this, the neighborhood game goes on, and there is a kid under a pile of leaves in the yard just under my window. He has been there a long time now, and everybody else is found, and they are about to give up on him over at the base. I consider going out to the base and telling them where he is hiding, and I thought about getting some leaves on fire to drive him out. Finally, I just yelled, "Get found, kid," and scared him so bad he probably wet his pants and started crying and ran home to tell his mother. It's real hard to know how to be helpful sometimes. A man I know found out last year he had terminal cancer. He was a doctor and knew about dying, and he didn't want to make his family and friends suffer through with him. So he kept his secret and died. Everybody said how brave he was to bear his suffering in silence and not tell everybody, and so on and so forth. But privately, his family and friends said how angry they were that he didn't need them, didn't trust their strength, and that it hurt that he didn't say goodbye. He hid too well. Getting found would have kept him in the game. Hide and seek, grown-up style. Wanting to hide, needing to be sought, confused about being found. I don't want anyone to know. What will people think? I don't want to bother anyone. Better than hide and seek, I like the game called Sardines. In Sardines, the person who is it goes and hides, and everybody goes looking for him. When you find him, you get in with him and hide there with him. Pretty soon, everyone is hiding together, all stacked in a small space like puppies in a pile. And pretty soon, somebody giggles and somebody laughs, and everybody gets found. And probably the part of this story that I like to focus on the most, and I'll repeat again, is hide-and-seek grown-up style. Wanting to hide, needing to be sought, confused about being found. And I've thought about this, and I thought how many times I've said, oh, you know, I feel so out of it. I'm single. I'm not married. I'm a loser. Nobody wants me. And then I've thought how often, hey, am I ready to be found? Am I ready to be given? If I have the opportunity of marriage and being with someone, am I ready for that? Am I hiding too well? Part of what I have learned the most from being single is learning how to be independent. And I know that there's a lot of criticism from a lot of people who feel like, well, you know, you need to learn how to be dependent on people. And another one of my favorite books is The Road Less Traveled. I'm sure that all of you have heard of it. It's by M. Scott Peck. And there are a couple of things that I'd like to share with you in this. And this really focuses, for me, on the importance of learning how to be comfortable and happy being single without having to be dependent on another person. The second most common misconception about love is the idea that dependency is love. This is a misconception which psychotherapists must deal with on a daily basis. Its effect is seen most dramatically in an individual who makes an attempt or gesture or threat to commit suicide or becomes incapacitatingly depressed in response to a rejection or a separation from a spouse or lover. Such a person says, "I do not want to live. I cannot live without my husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend. I love him or her so much, and when I respond, as I frequently do, you are mistaken. You do not love your husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend. What do you mean?" is the angry question. "I just told you I can't live without him." I try to explain. What you describe is a parasitism, not love. When you require another individual for your survival, you are a parasite on that individual. There is no choice, no freedom involved in your relationship. It is a matter of necessity rather than love. Love is the free exercise of choice. Two people love each other only when they are quite capable of living without each other, but choose to live with each other. And I love that, you know, and I think that, like each of you, maybe I'll assume, in growing up, I'm sure the thought has gone through your mind, oh, you know, I'll be so happy when I'm married, when I finally find that person who will make me happy and take all of these sad feelings away. When in reality, until we learn how to be individuals, I've always said that my ideal of a marriage is two people being independently dependent on each other, never giving up your identity, never giving up the person that you are. This is also taken from Dr. Peck's book. But let there be spaces in your togetherness, and let the winds of the heavens dance between you. Love one another, but make not a bond of love. Let it rather be a moving sea between the shores of your souls. Fill each other's cup, but drink not from one cup. Give another of your bread, but eat not from the same loaf. Sing and dance together and be joyous, but let each of you be alone. Even as the stirrings of a lute are alone, though they quiver with the same music. Give your hearts, but not into each other's keeping, for only the band of life can contain your hearts. And stand together, yet not too near together, for the pillars of the temple stand apart, and the oak tree and the cypress grows not in each other's shadow. One thing that has helped me, I believe, and this is solely my opinion, but I do believe that if I had the opportunity to be married at a younger age, that I probably would be divorced. And I believe that some people have things that they need to learn before they're married. Some people have things, lessons to learn while they are married. And other people learn things after a marriage. The important thing is that those things are learned. And one thing that helped, as I told you before, my dating experience has been fun. It's been frustrating. It's been tense. It's been a real learning experience. But I decided that I can do a lot to change the dating experience that I have. One of the things that has been extremely successful for me, and a lot of you might laugh at this, but after I had after I broke off an engagement 4 years ago, and thankfully so, because I was in love with the idea of getting married instead of being in love with the person that I was going to marry, I decided it would be beneficial for me to write a list. Not a list of what I was looking for in the person that hopefully I can find and share a life together with someday, but a list about the things I learned, a list about what I would change in a different relationship, in a relationship that will come up in the future. And this is something that's really worked for me. I know my father said to me, Jennifer, decide what you want, decide what you can deal with, and decide what you can't deal with, and then write that down and really stick by that. I have to laugh. A lot of the situations that I've gotten myself into in dating, I've asked for. I've gone into with my eyes wide open, but because of a need like all of us feel to have companionship and to want to have things be successful, sometimes we forget those things that will make us most happy. And I've appreciated the 10 years that I've had to learn more about myself, to learn what it is that Jennifer needs to grow, that Jennifer needs to be happy, and most of all, that I need to do so that I can be in a situation where I have the opportunity to give. I think I wrote a list of things that I feel are necessary for a successful relationship in the 90s. The first on this list is being honest with yourself. The second is accepting your weaknesses. Thirdly, being willing to grow, knowing what you can and can't do because there are limitations, not being cynical, looking at past closures of relationships as positive growth steps, and not comparing the timetable that you're on with another person's. For me, that was looking at my sisters and saying, that's okay, they're married, they have children, they're happy, they're doing what they want to do, and learning how I can be happy and positively progressing. And I feel that hopefully a time is not a concern for me. If I go the next 10 years, the next 20 years without being married, that's fine, as long as I am finding opportunities and ways of giving.
Sorry I was late. I had to get some mental fortification. I saw that I was listed on the program as divorced and a lawyer, and I didn't think that was much of an identity to bring to the panel. I'm a prodigal son too, so I can add that to my list. I put on my resume. I guess I'm the black sheep of the panel. I grew up in a family that was, I think, committed to the gospel, but not active in a conventional sense. I sort of did my own thing, just a typical young Mormon boy, and everybody had an expectation that I would go on a mission, and so I fulfilled their expectation. I'm glad that I did, though, because it was a beautiful experience and has been an anchor to my soul ever since, through thick and thin. I didn't date at all in high school. I was afraid of girls. Never held a girl's hand. Never kissed a girl. I think I had about 3 dates, was all. And I was a popular kid. I was a student body president and successful, I guess, in those terms, in high school. And so you can see already I was beginning to show some of the weirdness that has characterized me ever since. Anyway, I hung around in a group of friends, one of the girls that chummed around with us had red hair and freckles and just very delightful person, very engaging and easy to be with. Anyway, I asked her out to the graduation dance at high school, and we saw each other every day thereafter until I left on my mission. She wrote me every day. I think that's got to be in the Guinness Book of World Records. I'm not kidding. Every day I got a letter in the mail. And I came back, and 3 weeks later we were married. And very happily married. I prayed about this on my mission, and it was one of those fire in the bone experiences where you have an answer that is unmistakable. And I've never doubted that answer. She really is a soulmate to me, and still is. We were married for a long time. I can't count all the years, 15 years or so. And then divorced. It was a long separation. I, in terms of the separation and the divorce, it's been about 6 years for me now. And I was interested in those statistics, Robin, you know, the backlash statistics, which seemed to be more encouraging, and then the church statistics, which had more pessimism, and reminded me of a little cross stitch that my kids got me for Christmas. They know that I like the Star Wars trilogy, and that scene where they're flying in the Millennial Falcon through the asteroid field, and 3CPO is, you know, telling what a big chance they're taking, and Han Solo says, "Never tell me the odds," and so that's what my kids have got for me. Anyway, I don't know where all that gets me. I really didn't know what I had to offer, and Robin said, "Well, just tell your perspective and tell my story," and I guess that's what each of us has. We each have a different story. And there's a there's a scene in the Chronicles of Narnia, if you had, any of you have read those children's books by C.S. Lewis, where Aslan, the Christ figure, scratches this one child, and the other child says, you know, why did you hurt the girl and or the boy, I can't remember which. And he says, well, that's his or her story, and we're not really given to know another's. And it also reminded me of a fly leaf. In fact, I brought this with me. In one of the Potok novels, when a trout rising to a fly gets hooked on a line and finds himself unable to swim about freely, he begins with a fight which results in struggles and splashes and sometimes an escape. Often, of course, the situation is too tough for him. In the same way, the human being struggles with his environment and with the hooks that catch him. Sometimes he masters his difficulties. Sometimes they are too much for him. His struggles are all that the world sees, and it naturally misunderstands them. It is hard for a free fish to understand what is happening to a hooked one. And I think that's the predicament a lot of us have, being divorced or widowed or singled. But we have our story, and that's what we can share with one another. And so I can bring a little of my story to share. I don't know that I can find the words myself. I really struggled with that. So I brought some poetry. The poets always speak better than we can. What's it like to be divorced for me? The feeling I get is from a Yeats poem. We sat together at one summer's end. That beautiful, mild woman, your close friend, and you and I, and talked of poetry. I said, a line will take us hours, maybe, yet if it does not seem a moment's thought, our stitching and unstitching has been naught. Better go down upon your marrow bones and scrub a kitchen pavement or break stones like an old pauper in all kinds of weather. For to articulate sweet sounds together is to work harder than all these, and yet be thought an idler by the noisy set of bankers, schoolmasters, and clergymen the martyrs call the world. And thereupon that beautiful, mild woman, for whose sake there's many a one shall find out all heartache on finding that her voice is sweet and low, replied, to be born woman is to know, although they do not talk of it at school, that we must labor to be beautiful. I said, it's certain there is no fine things fall but needs much laboring. There have been lovers who thought the love should be so much compounded of high courtesy that they would sigh and quote with learned looks precedents out of beautiful old books. Yet now it seems an idle trait enough. We sat, grown quiet at the name of love. We saw the last embers of daylight die, and in the trembling blue-green of the sky a moon, worn as if it had been a shell washed by time's waters, as they rose and fell about the stars and broke in days and years. I had a thought for no one's but your ears, that you were beautiful, and that I strove to love you in the old high way of love, that it had all seemed happy, and yet we'd grown as weary-hearted as that hollow moon. It's that kind of bittersweetness where, you know, I think for me we were killing ourselves with love to some extent. But I do feel fortunate to still share that relationship with her as a very beautiful person. In fact, I agonized with her all week about, you know, what I was going to do here, and, you know, I didn't feel really a place here, and just very nervous and uptight, and she said, well, so we made a deal, and I'm meeting her after to buy her a blazer, and she's going to give me an hour and a half of help in processing this experience. So that's what divorce is like for me. We still go to the Trappers games together. I noticed they weren't mentioned, the Trappers. What's it like to be single for me? I really had a lot of idealism and had the feeling that you know, my free agency meant a lot. I could do a lot with it. It was a tremendous source of power, and I could reach the stars, and the sky was the limit. Now that I'm older, I still have that idealism, but I have it at the same time. Can be not a that the reach of my agency is not so broad as I once believed, that I am living with a lot of limitations. I'm more skeptical of power in man and the power in myself through agency or any other attribute. And I've come to appreciate there's a randomness and a serendipity in life that means more really than cause or cause and effect. I see the Savior as someone in many important respects is powerless. The power of the priesthood is powerlessness, that there's really only one choice, and that is to sacrifice the illusion of this thing I call my will to God. I have more faith in God and less in myself, and I'm learning to just accept life as it comes with all of its gifts. I think that's a hard thing for me, is to just be open and receive the gifts that come my way. And I've had a lot of those. I've climbed this mountain of marriage and, you know, a lot of stumbling and tripping and falling along the way, and failures and so forth. Well, I can celebrate those limitations at the same time as the new experience that I have now being single. Somebody once said that nothing happens by coincidence in God's world, and I'm trying to believe that, that there's a reason for me to be single, and I've overstepped my time, so I'll quit. Thank you very much.
Robin asked me to speak last, and I wasn't sure if that was because she wanted me to sum up, or if it's because being widowed is the one thing that we really don't think is ever going to happen to us, and that death is something that we will all somehow avoid. My divorced friends are also very quick to remind me that being widowed, however, is respectable in the church, where being divorced is not as respectable. I hear someone in the audience say, it's true, it's true. Well, what I say to the people that tell me that, and a Relief Society president where I live at the present time recently told me this also, I say, wait a minute. You talk about rejection, which is what divorced people suffer. I said, my rejection came from a higher source. There were prayers that were not answered that could have been. I believe in miracles, and the miracle didn't happen for me. So I think about one of the things that Robin and I were taught when we did this self-awareness retreat where we met, and it was that there are no accidents in life. And as Alan just spoke, he is trying to, you know, believe that things happen for a reason. I don't know why I am a widow, except I do know that I am. And what happened to me was I was raised in an inactive LDS family and was bribed to go to BYU by my father, who purchased a brand new pair of head skis for me if I would go there. And my older siblings had gone there and had come out pretty well, so he thought that's what I should do, and that's what I did. At the time of my graduation, I attended an Arizona stomp and met a haired boy from central Utah who was about to go to Vietnam for the Air Force as a pilot. And we got married 60 days later. I wouldn't recommend it, but it worked for us. I was graduating. He was going in the military. We had a very exciting life. We had a great time. It wasn't a perfect marriage, but it was a very good marriage. We were best friends. And in May of 1985, he won the race at the Father and Sons outing for our ward. I was 39 and he was 42. He was told a week later that he had about 3 months to live. He was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer. For those of us that watched Michael Landon on TV, you can guess what my husband's experience was because it was very similar. He, however, outlived the diagnosis and lived for 7 months. During that time, my daughter was 16, my son was 14, and my little one was 4. When my husband died, I lost my job because I had worked with him. I lost my mate. I lost my lover. I lost my sense of being. I lost my center in a way because I believed when I got married that I would be married forever to him. I believed that we would live a long and happy life together. It didn't work out that way. So after the death, as my ward, who had been very supportive and very helpful, sighed a great relief that now they didn't have to worry about poor Kathleen anymore because Dave had died and now she could get on with her life. And that is what they assumed that I would do the next week. And it didn't quite happen that way. But as they sighed this relief and stepped back from me and my home teacher and dear friend for many years, who very soon stopped coming around because he had never brought a companion, and to come alone was not acceptable. I was soon left without that support and without many other supports. Widows don't get relief from the children either. You know, there are no weekends with Daddy. There are few escapes from the constant visual of watching your children. But I'll tell you who bailed me out, and that was my non-Mormon friends. I have a wide circle of friends that I've gathered over the years of living around the country and living here as well, many who are not LDS. And it was to these people that I was still an acceptable person. Not that I wasn't acceptable to the LDS people or to the ward, but I was an oddity. I didn't fit in the family ward. There weren't other single people in our ward in the area that I was living. And so my non-member friends reached out to me. They were the ones that called and said, I know it's somebody's birthday, why don't you come over? They're the ones that said, let's decorate the Christmas tree together. Mormon families are families that do not really reach out a lot to the single counterparts. And this is true. The bishop used to say to me, well, what can we do? What can we do to help? And I didn't really have any good answers, but I would keep prodding, you know, let's, you know, just reach out. Let's be Christian. Let's reach out and help each other. Let's just accept people as people. I believe Kent brought that out. And one of the things that they did, which was really great, the second year after Dave's death, they said, we've got it, Kathleen. We've got a ward function that we're going to invite the single people to. And it's really going to be neat because you're really going to like this. We are going to have a table just for the single people. It's going to be so neat. Well, that really is a joke to those who are single because we don't feel any different from those who are married. I noticed that we never call the married people in the ward the marrieds. I belong to a marrieds ward. An interesting fact, too, regarding the church, I had a talk with the Stake Relief Society president one day, and she said, you know, Kathleen, you're really in a great position. You're sealed to your husband, and so now you can marry anybody, and it won't matter. You know, it's, widows are kind of in the ozone out here somewhere. But what I experienced was that I was raising three teenagers, my 16-year-old, my 14-year-old, and myself. And as we went through the dating process, it was terrible that I had to be home before they were. Or, you know, no one would know what time they got home. And my daughter said to me the other day, I'm in the process of building a new home, and she said, oh, you can't get rid of your king-size bed. She said, we remember so many times all laying there and talking about our dates. And it's true that that's what we've done, and I will have to talk with Robin afterwards to find out just who these relationships I have are with that are not dating. I'm not really sure. I have refused to be uncomfortable in a family ward, and it's interesting to me to hear the comments about the single people wanting to be in a family ward. I have attended a family ward for the purpose of the fact that I was raising my children, and always thought that I would want to be in a single ward. I don't know how I'll feel when my children are raised, but I have refused to be uncomfortable in the ward that I'm in. But that has taken some doing. That has taken some outspoken forwardness, which sometimes gets me in trouble, but has also been very good. The trouble I'm in now is that I'm the Cub Master. I do believe that it's important to raise my children in the church and to therefore maintain my activity. If I didn't have my children, I don't know what my activity level would be. Although I do have a very strong testimony of the church, I consider myself more spiritual than religious. I've recently moved to St. George, Utah, and there are very few single men under 60 there. I am under 60. I'm also under 50, so we didn't say that. But I moved there for a particular purpose. As my two older children were in college, I removed the nest from them to the south because I was working and enjoying my work a little too much, and found that my four-year-old, who was growing up without a father, was also partly growing up without a mother. And so my move constituted a reawakening within myself as far as what my role was. And I chose, upon my husband's death, to stay an active member of the church. It's been difficult to do that. It's been difficult, excuse me, for a lot of reasons. One of them is the quote that Robin and I share on occasion. The Shakespeare quote about, if I gain the thing I seek. And I think this is something that we can relate to in all phases of our life. A dream, a breath, a froth of fleeting joy. Who buys a minute's mirth to wail a week, or sells eternity to get a toy? For one sweet grape, who would the vine destroy? Or what fond beggar but to touch the crown would with the scepter straight be stricken down? There are a lot of pitfalls to being single. One of them is the sexual, I can't even say it. It's so hard to deal with. The sexual issue is very difficult. There are times when I wish that I did not carry that burden of being responsible in that area. But it is a choice that I've made, and it's a choice that I live with and I deal with. If I had the opportunity to say, you know, what I wanted, I would want to be married. I've been married, I've been single, I prefer to be married. But I also had a very good experience being married, and I choose to have that same experience. And maybe I'm too picky, maybe I'm being too exclusive, but I know what I need, and like Robin, I'm trying to find others who share those same kinds of needs. And so I go out of my way to be physically active and to do those kinds of things, to surround myself with people who have similar goals and aspirations that I have. So that is what I bring to this panel, and I hope that we have time for questions, but thank you.
Yeah, I think we need to ask some questions, and I just ask you to come up to the mic so that I don't have to try and repeat your question, and we'll just try and answer them as honestly as we can.
I feel that, you know, why am I a Mormon and a single person? Because I've been single for 27 years, and as you can imagine, the sexual... I was hoping that the sexual issue would be raised and developed more than it has been, because I think it's a very vital and necessary thing that has to be discussed, because all we think, all we're taught in the church when we're single is, you know, abstinence before marriage. And when I first came to Utah 14 years ago, I had had a couple of affairs which I wasn't excommunicated for. I don't know why, but I wasn't. And then when I came to Utah, I thought, now I've come to the celestial kingdom, so to speak, and I'll be meeting guys that are going to appreciate me as a woman, and the sex will be left alone. Anyway, I went to a dance at the Terrace, I think it was, and I met this guy, and he was a good dancer, and that's all I liked about him. And he kept asking me to go out with him, and I didn't. And then one time he told me that he was a high councilman, and he says, "Don't you ever want a necking session?" And I said, "No, I don't want a necking session. I want to meet somebody who has my principles." But none of you have really told us how you handle being non-sexual. And you know, so just before he responds to that, I'm just making sure nobody's here that knows me before I say what I want to say. And what I want to say is that a few years ago, I was working at the University of Utah and as a supervisor, and my employees were students, and they took me to a nightclub, and they were not active Mormons, and I was, and I fell in love with a black blues man, and he fell in love with me, and he didn't live here, but we saw each other about 6 months, you know, and of course, he thought I was from outer space when I told him that I was a Mormon and that I was chaste and all that bullshit, put it bluntly. But anyway, he came over unexpectedly, and he wasn't performing in the club. And so I was very nervous because I really liked him a lot, you know, very attracted to him physically, and I'd held myself in. And he'd been a perfect gentleman. And then when he came unexpectedly, he was going to stay. He assumed that he was staying over, and I thought, oh, what the hell? And so everything went, you know. So when he left, then the guilt came. And so I went to my bishop and told him. And I said, I'm not sorry either. Well, he was a new bishop, and he was very young. And he said... very serious, this is Lillian, it's very serious. So, you know, we had a court, and oh, it was just terrible. I mean, I volunteered my sin, and there was this debate whether they were going to, you know, put me on Alcatraz for 10 years or something. And one of the counselors said, of all the people in the ward, I would never have thought that you would do anything like that, you know. I mean, he'd been doing it every night for the past 50 years, probably. But here am I, you know, I'd been celibate for, you know, 12 years, for God's sake. I mean, I thought I'd done pretty good. But anyway, to cut a long story short, and I hope I don't want to take everybody's time, but I was disfellowshipped. Now, I was disfellowshipped for a long time. When I met this guy again, I told him that I didn't want to continue that relationship. And he said, oh, I can't understand this Mormonism. He said, do they still want your money? I said, oh, yes. So I paid my tithing regularly, and then I moved to three different wards, and I had to tell each bishop, and I had to go to sacrament meeting and not put my hand up and not partake of the sacrament. And then after about 9 months, my sister was in England, and she was dying of cancer, and I had to go. And I didn't want to go. It was being disfellowshipped. So I went back to this to my bishop, and he said, you'll have to go back to the original bishop. I went back to the original bishop. Oh, no, you know, you've not repented. You know. And I said, look, I know that I've been forgiven. I've forgiven myself, and I know that Heavenly Father's forgiven me. What right have you to deny me? You know, traveling 7,000 miles in this situation. But he wouldn't. He wouldn't, and I had to go home, and I had to be with my sister in that situation, and I had to go to the ward there and still not sustain and be a part of the service, and it was very, very difficult. I came home, my sister died, and about 3 months later, the bishop said, I think